Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
With all the big news yesterday, the BP oil leak finally, hopefully, coming to an end, the financial regulation bill passing the Senate, you may have missed the part where Goldman Sachs pays a $550 million fine to the SEC. Sounds like a lot, but for Goldman, it's not. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. It is the 16th day of July. The Securities and Exchange Commission accused Goldman Sachs back in April of selling mortgage-backed securities to clients and not disclosing that those securities were designed by a firm that wanted them to fail. This was supposedly the case that would signal new toughness on the part of government regulators. But for Goldman, $500 million is lunch money. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has more from New York.
If the stock price of Goldman Sachs is any guide, then the investment bank definitely came out on top. Despite today's sell-off on Wall Street, Goldman shares are up. Securities lawyer Bill Singer doesn't label Goldman a winner, but he doesn't bestow that title on the SEC either.
The SEC got the largest settlement in the history of that regulator, which was $500 million. But that has to be viewed against the size of Goldman Sachs.
It's a company that handed out $16 billion in bonuses last year. All Goldman had to admit to in the settlement was that it made a mistake, no admission of fraud.
Admitting to a mistake is still admitting to something.
Elizabeth Nowicki is a former SEC attorney who teaches corporate law at Tulane.
If a case is truly weak, a case being contemplated by the SEC, there's not going to be any sort of admission by the settling party.
And Fordham University securities law professor Steve Thiel calls the settlement a great deal for the SEC.
Anybody who thinks the SEC didn't get very much has a pretty low opinion of $500 million. Now, the SEC didn't destroy the firm, and the SEC didn't force a departure of the chief executive, but that's not the SEC's job.
And the settlement isn't necessarily the last word on the matter. There is still the possibility of criminal charges, and some on Wall Street suspect management changes ahead as Goldman tries to repair its reputation. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
If you were driving down a desert highway in Arizona late last night, you witnessed something big. No exploding cacti or anything like that, but the State Department of Public Safety shut off all its speed trap cameras at 11:59 p.m. It's back to old-fashioned patrol car enforcement, despite the fact that the cameras reduced speeding and brought money into the struggling state's coffers, Eve Tro reports.
The Arizona legislature spent $20 million to install speed cameras on state roads where there were lots of accidents. The cameras catch anyone going more than 10 miles over the speed limit. Arizona State University economist Tim James says the cameras greatly reduce speeding, but he says many drivers don't think that's the point.
There's always a perception that really what it's about is not trying to control people's behaviors, but it's a program that's always driven by revenue generation.
James is from the UK, where speed cameras have been widely used and disliked for years.
Speed cameras are referred to as state money boxes or piggy banks.
In Arizona, the cameras have brought in much less money than expected. The program collected about $78 million in the past 2 years, less than half of what the government predicted. Russ Rader is spokesperson for the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. He says decreased revenue shows the program is working.
So the camera programs may generate a lot of tickets initially, but that revenue tails off as the camera slow drivers down.
Rader says calling the cameras a sneaky way to tax citizens is just a ruse for what's really going on. Lots of people think speeding is okay.
Let's face it, we all speed to a certain degree during our daily driving. But the idea that we should let people set their own speed limits at more than 10 miles an hour over the posted limit is just ludicrous.
The Arizona Department of Public Safety says it would like to put more officers on the road now that the cameras are shut off, but the state simply doesn't have the money. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Users of the iPhone 4 got an offer they cannot refuse from Apple godfather Steve Jobs today, a free rubber bumper that covers the gadget's dropout-plagued antenna. Jobs apologized to consumers for the inconvenience, but still insisted there's nothing really wrong with the iPhone's design because other smartphones share the same problem. Marketplace senior business correspondent Bob Moon tells us some marketing types wonder if that's going to be enough, even for Apple's famously loyal followers.
Although he was conciliatory, Jobs was far from contrite. He opened his news conference with a customer's musical defense of the iPhone 4.
If you don't want an iPhone 4, don't buy it. If you bought one and you don't like, bring it back.
We saw that on YouTube this morning and couldn't help but want to share it.
Jobs defended the iPhone at length, pointed fingers at competitors' phones, and suggested the iPhone 4 looks so good users just aren't opting to buy protective casings.
We've heard it from a lot of people. Why don't you just give everybody a case? Okay, great. Let's give everybody a case.
The offer is good through September, and those who've already bought the cases can get a refund, but Jobs insisted there's no giant problem the company needs to fix. Former Apple marketing executive John Martellaro, now an editor at MacObserver.com, thinks Jobs came up short.
You have to show that you're taking care of your customers, not just saying that you're taking care of your customers.
He points out Jobs was reduced to claiming the iPhone is no less flawed than other smartphones, and that, he says, may force Apple to act a little less superior. One PR expert we spoke to thinks Apple loyalists will be satisfied. Patrick Curley is with Levick Strategic Communications. He concedes he's an iPhone user and Apple stockholder.
I think in the long term, what will be remembered today is if the fix works, not whether there was an apology that was graceful enough.
Which is what Apple seemed to be banking on when it all but dared customers to return their phones.
Bring it back to the Apple Store. But you know you won't.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Investors did not appreciate some of today's earnings reports and sent the major indexes down more than 2%. We will have details when we do the numbers. It's kind of nice, no, actually more than kind of nice, it's really nice to click on that video feed from the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico and see nothing but water. There was never any sound on that video, but it just feels quiet. For the first time in almost 3 months, oil is not spewing into the Gulf. But the damage to communities remains. So this week, the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, and other regulators issued guidance to banks telling them to help Gulf residents with their spill-induced money woes. Chrissy Clark reports.
Banking regulators often issue statements like these after hurricanes and floods. This is the first for a man-made disaster. The goal is to help out people like Chip Dupree. He's a fishing guide from Mobile, Alabama, makes his living bringing tourists to waters full of speckled trout. But since the oil showed up...
All I can say is devastating. Having to call somebody and say I'm going to be a month late on payments for cars and mortgages. It's awful.
Dupree uses local banks. He says so far they've given him some leeway, but he says friends who bank with national firms haven't gotten much sympathy for what's going on in the Gulf.
There's credit card companies out there that have no idea.
Steve Fritz is with the FDIC, one of the agencies who issued the statement to local and national banks.
We suggested the need for banks to recognize the economic circumstances that their customers are facing.
And to consider waiving late fees, restructuring debts, and easing credit terms for those hurt by the spill. Sounds nice. Just one catch.
Well, there is no way to enforce it.
And as the mortgage crisis shows, just because the feds ask banks to work with customers doesn't mean they will. But Alex Sanchez with the Florida Bankers Association says his members have an incentive to help their customers. They need their business in the long run.
But we need the regulators' help, because remember, when these businesses fall behind on their loans, that threatens the banks in the panhandle.
Regulators say they'll consider the spill's unusual circumstances when they look at the books of banks doing business in the Gulf. But those tighter standards put in place since the financial crisis, even in the Gulf, they still apply. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace. So this week, Goldman Sachs settled with the SEC over those fraud charges the agency brought back in April. And a big win for the White House, as we are now well on the way to Wall Street reform. Joining us today for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and very much beyond are John Carney from CNBC and Felix Salmon of Reuters. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hi, Tess.
Thanks for having us.
Financial reform passed the Senate yesterday in a bit of a squeaker. Now that it's here, do we feel any differently about it, Felix?
I think we're very happy about it. Given the political realities, I think this is a spectacularly good result.
John, will this keep us from having another financial crisis in the future?
Oh, of course it won't. First of all, I'm nowhere near as happy about it as Felix. I don't think it goes far enough. I don't think it really does very much of anything. But I do think that expecting it to keep us out of a financial crisis in the future is probably asking too much.
John is right. There's nothing in the bill which will prevent a future financial crisis. And the real dangerous stuff is going to be kept in check by new rules which are being negotiated in Basel, Switzerland right now, not by anything in a reform bill. But what happens is when those rules go into place, once this stuff called Basel III has finally been negotiated, then it's up to the U.S. regulatory infrastructure to make sure that the financial system plays by the new rules. And before this bill came into effect, the regulatory structure in the U.S. just wasn't able to do that.
I agree with Felix on that. Basel III is very important. Unfortunately, again, to sound the kind of doom grinder once more, I'm not convinced that the people setting these capital requirements understand how to measure risk very well, and that's what they're trying to do. Every time they try to do these risk-weighted capital requirements, they end up pushing everybody into one trade, which sets the stage for a collapse, and they're going to do it all over again.
All right. Well, you know, I'd love to talk about Basel for the next several days, but I would actually rather have it in my pesto. So let's move on and ask, you know, now that this big question of what's in the reform bill has been answered, I wonder about all the people who have been using that as an excuse for their investor behavior. Oh, I don't know what's going to happen with that. The banks have used that as an excuse not to lend because they don't know what's going to be in the bill. So are we back to normal here?
We do return to normal, but it was the horrible norm that led us down the path to disaster in the first place. Already people are talking about bank earnings and how that's going to play out in the future. The great risk posed to our entire economy by financial behemoths that are out of control still remains. So yeah, we're back to normal, but it's the normal of the person swimming in the ocean while Jaws comes up beneath them.
Oh, yikes, Felix.
Well, yeah, in that sense, what we want is this slogan, which is popularized by your compatriots in California, of the new normal, something which is where you have much more government oversight in the economy and much less freedom. That's the kind of normal, new normal that we want. If we go back to the old normal, John's absolutely right. That's the last thing that we want.
Let's spend a couple of minutes on Goldman and that settlement with the SEC, $550 million. Felix, I know you've practically describe this as a gift, right?
Right. This is a couple of weeks' profit for Goldman. They can find $550 million lying down the back of the sofa. This is less than the fine that AIG got fined for doing accounting irregularities. This is a slap on the wrist, basically, and Goldman is laughing all the way to the bank.
John, does this really mean anything? Did we all get our pound of flesh from a financial crisis villain?
the public education that may have come from an actual trial could have been a lot more useful than the $550 million that the SEC got them to cough up.
Felix, any long-term ramifications of this?
Really, what it does is it just confirms Goldman Sachs' ability to do whatever it wants. Goldman, it has impunity, essentially.
All right. On that note, Felix Salmon, John Carney, thank you both and happy weekend.
Thank you, Tiz.
Have a great weekend.
Coming up, here's what happens when chefs skip the restaurant and take the food straight to the customers.
I mean, the business is just, I don't even know, it's gone through the roof. It's just crazy.
But first, let's do the numbers. Anxious consumers spread misery all over the markets today. The Dow sheared off 2.5%, 261 points, to close at 10,097. The Nasdaq gave back 3.1%, 70 points, to end at 2179. The S&P 500 retreated 2.8%, 31 points, to finish at 1064. For the week that was, the Dow fell 1%, the Nasdaq was off 0.8%, and the S&P 500 dropped 1.2%. Bank of America plunged more than 9% after a disappointing quarterly earnings report. Citigroup lost more than 6%. Apple's mea sort of culpa didn't hurt its shares too much. Stock in the iPhone maker dialed back 2/3%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. By the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by MassMutual, offering Save the Game, a financial literacy app for children designed for iPod Touch and iPhone, available on the App Store. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the U.S. Department of Commerce, the White House, and the FCC commemorate the 20th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. The event will highlight technologies that empower Americans with disabilities. And download some Elvis to your iTunes this weekend. On July 19, 1954, That's All Right, Mama was released by Sun Records. It was Elvis Presley's first single. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. The U.S. Census is over and done with, at least for the next 10 years. In Britain, it might just be over. The government there is mulling whether to completely scrap the national census, which has taken place virtually every decade since 1801. But it costs $700 million to conduct. And as the country is counting its pennies, there may be cheaper ways of counting the population. Joining us from London is Marketplace's Stephen Beard. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Tess.
Is this really just about money, or is there some other reason for the government wanting to scrap it?
Money is a big part of the argument, but there are doubts about the value of this exercise as a way of measuring the population and allocating public funds. You may remember the last census here in 2001 was famous for a joke. 400,000 people listed their religion on the form as Jedi. But even some serious statisticians like Professor Les Mayhew of the Cass Business School have doubts about the usefulness of the census.
It's increasingly inaccurate. Huge difficulties in collecting the data. People don't fill in the forms or answer the doors. And it takes about 2 years before the results are published.
Well, that does seem to pose some issues. But, Stephen, is the census mandatory there as it is
here in the US?
Yes, very much so. I mean, officially, there's a fine of $1,500 if you don't fill in the form. Nevertheless, 3 million people didn't complete the census last time round. By the way, only 100 of those were prosecuted.
3 million people didn't do that. Now, what percentage of the population is that?
It's about 5%.
5%. So that's pretty good by American standards, actually. British government, though, doesn't think it's good enough?
Well, the government thinks it can get the information much more cheaply and more accurately from other sources by trawling through public databases like voter registration records, tax records, immigration records, and so on. This, says the government, would be certainly more up to date than the census information that takes 2 years to process and then isn't updated until the next census.
Does the census have any supporters?
Yes, genealogists rather like it. I mean, for tracing the family tree, it's quite useful having all this information in one place. And there are some academics that say they prefer the census too. Sean Rickard of the Cranfield School of Management says he definitely doesn't like the alternative.
We would prefer to fill out a census openly and honestly once every 10 years rather than have governments pouring into our bank accounts, into our health records, into our school records or whatever to try and make sense of it.
Actually, some of the fiercest opposition to the next census has come from civil libertarians. They complain that it's 32 pages long and full of prying questions like, who spent the night in your house on such and such a date?
Oh, my.
One group, Big Brother Watch, is urging members to fill in names like Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck. So it'll be interesting to see how many people are prosecuted after this next census, which the government says will probably be the last one.
Well, and I do need to point out that both Mickey and Donald are Americans. So Marketplace's Stephen Beard joining us from London. Thank you so much.
Okay, Tess.
If you can't take the heat, get out of the restaurant business, because it is a scorcher. A recent study out of Ohio State found 3 out of every 5 restaurants around the country fail within 3 years. So chefs are getting a little creative. You're probably familiar with the food truck craze. Who needs square footage when you've got wheels? And now some enterprising chefs in the Bay Area have found another way to go mobile. April Demboski reports.
It's Wednesday evening in a rundown industrial neighborhood of Oakland, California. Hundreds of people file into an old brick building that used to be a trolley car garage. But on this night, it's the site of the Bay Area's latest foodie craze, a kind of farmer's market for specialty gourmet food called the Pop-Up General Store.
I'm not going to say this too loud, but I came with nothing but an appetite and a wad of cash.
Tracy Nielsen and her friend Devin Fenimore brave 20 miles of rush hour traffic to get here. They elbow their way past tables of duck confit, handmade rigatoni, and carrot cupcakes with goat cheese frosting. They stop at the table of Chef Chelsea Pence and sample her maple bacon shortbread cookies.
Nice texture, soft, yet moist. Oh, and the saltiness from the bacon and the sweetness of the maple. Oh, wait for it. Praline.
Mm-hmm. It's like breakfast in my mouth.
A few days before this installment of the pop-up store, participating chefs posted a list of items they'd be making. Customers placed orders online and came here to pick them up. Organizers say this direct-to-consumer model is helpful for young chefs looking to make a name for themselves in the food industry.
It's just kind of like a little incubator for businesses.
Samin Nosrat and her business partner, Christopher Lee, started the pop-up last winter. They were mourning the closure of their high-end Italian restaurant and trying to figure out what to do next.
We've realized that the current paradigm of what it means to be a food business owner is a really difficult thing. There are just so many costs involved. If you want to continue cooking and you want to continue connecting with customers, then you have to be creative.
They imagined a venue where chefs could bypass restaurants altogether. Their first pop-up in January brought out a couple chefs and a handful of patrons. Now it draws dozens of cooks and hundreds of people.
This is like kind of a brilliant scheme for creating new business because it was really low financial investment for us and it's really low risk. And from time to time, we can really accurately gauge what the response is and change things.
Okay, your total is $212.25, please.
That's been Chelsea Pence's experience. She scrapped her walnut maple caramels after customers gave them the thumbs down. Now she's focusing mostly on salty sweet treats.
I mean, the business is just, I don't even know, it's gone through the roof. It's just crazy.
Pence has a full-time job as a cook at a Berkeley restaurant, but she thinks she's getting more of a career boost from the pop-up store.
A gentleman from Modern Coffee came in today, which is a brand new coffee shop that opened in downtown Oakland, and he wants to start selling my biscotti at his coffee shop. So, like, slowly but surely, things are kind of picking up, and I'm going to have more outlets than just here to sell my baked goods.
It's all part of her master plan, to build a name and attract investors so she can one day open her own business. In Oakland, I'm April Dembosky for Marketplace. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And as we wrap things up today, how about a moment to get away from BP and the banks and review some of the other news of the week? Items that, shall we say, didn't quite make the headlines. Courtesy of Brendan Newnham, Rico Galliano, and some of the staff here at Marketplace.
Patty Hirsch, senior editor for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about at your dinner parties this weekend?
I'm going to be talking about the CEO of Spirit Airlines.
Why?
Because apparently this guy believes that baggage is not essential when you're going on vacation.
Psychological baggage?
No, any baggage at all. Even a carry-on. It's seen as a luxury and they're going to charge you for it.
When he said that, was he unshaven and wearing a rumpled suit?
Jeremy Hobson, New York reporter. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, Rico, here in New York, we have these unlimited Metro cards that allow you to use the subway or the buses as much as possible.
Right.
Well, now, because of budget cuts, the MTA wants to make it so that you can only use your unlimited card 90 times throughout the month.
So the unlimited card will not actually be unlimited.
Exactly. What's next here? You're going to limit the amount of breadsticks you can get at the Olive Garden to 90? It seems unreasonable.
You know, I also have to say, New York has a history of this. The city that never sleeps. I know that portions of the Bronx sleep. I'm pretty sure Flatbush sleeps. You're all hyperbole, New York.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter at Marketplace. What's your story this weekend?
The U.S. Postal Service has just announced it's releasing a new series of stamps based on the funnies.
The funnies? What are the funnies?
The funnies from the newspaper.
Oh, I see. So from, like, the Sunday comics.
Yes, from the comics.
Well, I guess this makes sense because the only people who buy newspapers are probably the same people who buy stamps.
I buy stamps. You don't buy stamps?
Like, their next collection's going to have landline phones on it.
And that's just a taste of what Rico and Brendan can do. You can get the full serving on their podcast. It's called The Dinner Party Download. We have a link at marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow sheared off 2.5%, 261 points. The NASDAQ gave back 3.1%, 70 points. And the S&P 500 reversed 2.8%, that's 31 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is JJ Yore. Coming up on our weekend personal finance show, Marketplace Money, if you've ever called your health insurance company and tried to get through that phone tree, you are not alone.
You don't know how many consumers will immediately try to find what's the one number that's going to get me out of this box and into a live agent. Do you do it? You're laughing because you do it, aren't you?
Yes, I certainly do. I'm Tess Viglund. Have a great weekend.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.